I'm Nathan Rutherford, and welcome to Myth Madness. The next few episodes will cover the myths surrounding not just one hero, but a whole crew of them. This group, called the Argonauts, are led by a man named Jason. They all go on a quest to retrieve a fabulous treasure called the Golden Fleece. This is a special adventure. It is one of several events in Greek myth where a large group of heroes from the same generation come together for one specific reason. Another great example of an event like this is the Trojan War, but the heroes in this Argonaut quest belong to an earlier generation of heroes, which is why the podcast is covering it first. Some of the names in this story are going to be familiar. Some of the heroes involved I've already talked about, and for some others, this quest is one of their earlier adventures, so you'll hear their names again in future episodes. The main source for this story is a long epic poem called the Argonautica. It was written in the Hellenistic period of ancient Greece, in the 3rd century BC, by a man named Apollonius of Rhodes. The story itself was already widely known at the time, but Apollonius's treatment of it became very influential. I'll be using the Argonautica as the backbone of my retelling of the Argonauts' adventures. Another major source will be Apollodorus's library, as it contains additional details on the lead-up to the quest. The story revolves around the royal family ruling over the Greek city of Iolcos, located in Thessaly in central Greece. Iolcos is kind of a strange setting for this great adventure. Unlike a lot of the other cities Greek myths are set in, Sparta, Athens, Thebes, Mycenae, there's really no indication that Iolcos was a particularly important place in ancient Greek history. According to myth, the city was founded by a man named Cretheus. He was one of the brothers of the kings Salmoneus and Sisyphus. I talked about the rivalry between the brothers Salmoneus and Sisyphus back a few episodes ago. Cretheus was married to Tiro, his niece and Salmoneus's daughter. Tiro and Cretheus had 3 sons, Aeson, Pheres, and Amythaon. Aeson is the most important. The other 2 moved away and don't do much in this story. Like a lot of ancient Greek mythological women, Tiro was very beautiful, and like a lot of her peers, that made her get the attention of some of the gods. In her case, her admirer was Poseidon. However, this love triangle between Cretheus, Tiro, and Poseidon is actually more of a love rectangle, because Tiro wanted someone else. She was attracted to a river spirit named Enipeus, and would often sit next to his river, hoping to get his attention. Poseidon knew this, and one day disguised himself as Enipeus, appeared to Tiro, and tricked her. From this, she got pregnant with 2 sons named Peleas and Neleus, but gave birth to them in secret, and left them to die in the countryside so she could return to her family with Cretheus. Of course, this is a myth, and it seems sometimes there's an unwritten rule in myth that if a baby is left to die, he most certainly is not going to die. This rule held true for Peleas and Neleus. They were found by some horsekeepers, adopted, and raised to adulthood. Somehow, they determined who their mother was, found out where she lived, learned she was being mistreated by her father's new wife, Sidero, and showed up to rescue her. They attacked Sidero, and when she tried to flee into a temple dedicated to the goddess Hera, Peleas chased after her and stabbed her to death inside, greatly offending Hera in the process. This same Peleas ended up as the king of Iolcos after Cretheus died. His twin brother Neleus went and became the king of Pylos. Now, why did Peleas become king of Iolcos instead of Cretheus' own son, Aeson? It's never exactly explained why, but I think it's fair to say that Peleas got the best of his half-brother and took over. Aeson himself was married to a woman whose name is different in the different sources. In Apollonius's Argonautica, she is named Alcimede. In other places, like the earlier Catalog of Women, she is called Polymede. Either way, Aeson and his wife have a son named Jason. In ancient Greek, his name is more properly Aeson, but Jason is the more commonly used pronunciation today. Jason is going to be the main hero in the story of the Argonauts, and he's a bit of an unusual hero for a couple different reasons. One of them concerns his parents. Unlike a lot of the other heroes I've covered on the pod so far, Jason doesn't have any immortal parents. He is human, on both sides. Although, if you accept the tradition that his mother may be the daughter of Autolycus, then Jason is technically a great-grandson of Hermes. Even though he may not have the lineage of heroes, Jason does have the training. As early as the late Archaic period, in the Catalog of Women, a young Jason was taken to the woods around Mount Pelion and raised by the centaur Chiron, a teacher for a handful of other heroes. You can assume that what happened here was that Pelias and Aeson fought for the throne of Iolcos. Pelias became king, and Aeson's son Jason was sent away to be tutored by Chiron. This conveniently got the young Jason away from his cruel half-uncle, Pelias. Years pass, and Jason grew into a young man, and it is at this point that Apollonius' Argonautica picks up. King Pelias ruled Iolcos with a strong hand, but as long as he had the support of the gods, he wasn't going anywhere. To keep their support, he was sure to keep up a steady stream of sacrifices. The temples of Iolcos were always full of sweet-smelling smokes that wafted up from the best fats and meats. Pelias held great banquets to honor his father Poseidon and thank the gods for his prosperity. For some reason, though, he ignored the goddess Hera, and the Queen of Heaven determined he would pay. News of these great feasts drifted far and wide. Eventually, a mature Jason heard of them. He left his home with the centaur Chiron and traveled overland to his birthplace of Iolcos. On his way, he had to cross the cold waters of the Anaurus River. He couldn't find a ferry, so he had to walk across. In some versions, he carries an old woman on his shoulders to help her across too. While making his way through the swirling water, his feet got stuck in the mud, and pulling himself on, one of his sandals was left behind. He shrugged his shoulders and continued on without it. Days later, and Jason arrived at Pelias's feast. Pelias watched the man elbow his way through the merrymakers and noticed his single sandal. Pelias grew quiet and afraid. Why the fear? Well, an oracle had previously told Pelias he would be killed by a man who arrives out of a crowd and wears only one sandal. Seeing Jason arrive out of a large group of banquet-goers and not exactly dressed in formal banquet wear made Pelias sense his impending doom. He spent the banquet sitting quietly, devising an elaborate scheme allowing him to send the mysterious visitor on a dangerous voyage, hoping he would either be killed at sea or murdered by barbarians and never return home. In the Argonautica, Pelias comes up with an impossible mission for Jason and challenges him to it. But in Apollodorus' library, the challenge occurs in a slightly different way. Pelias approaches Jason and asks him what he would do if an oracle told him a man was going to kill him. Jason tells Pelias he would send him to retrieve the Golden Fleece, an impossible task. Pelias thought, "Great idea, Jason," and then Pelias ordered him to do exactly that. So that's how Jason gets his impossible task. But what exactly is the Golden Fleece? The Golden Fleece's mythological origins go back another generation to the family of Cadmus, the founder of Thebes. I talked about Cadmus and his family a few episodes ago. Cadmus had a handful of daughters, and one of them was a woman named Ino. She was married to Athamas, the king of Orchomenus, a powerful city located fairly close to Thebes. But Ino was not Athamas's first wife. His first was a goddess named Nephele, and their two children were a boy named Phrixus and a girl named Helle. Eventually, Nephele left to do goddess things, and Athamas married Ino. Ino is an ancient example of the evil stepmother. She hated her stepchildren, Phrixus and Helle, and wanted them dead. She had her chance when a terrible drought plagued the land. An oracle was asked how it could be ended, and Ino bribed the oracle, or the messenger coming back from the oracle, to lie and say that the drought would end if Athamas sacrificed his son, Phrixus. Upon hearing these instructions, Athamas reluctantly agreed and began sharpening his sacrificial knives and preparing the altar of Zeus to receive his son's blood. But right before Athamas performed this terrible deed, his old wife Nephele reappeared. The gods did not want this human sacrifice to go forward, so the god Hermes went to Nephele and gave her a ram with golden wool. She took this ram to her son and daughter, sat them on its back, and sent them off. The golden ram could fly, and it carried Phrixus and Helle away from their father and evil stepmother and carried them over land and sea. Unfortunately, during the ride, Helle fell off and drowned in the sea, but Phrixus was carried out of Greece all the way to a faraway place called Colchis. Once he safely arrived, he sacrificed the ram with the golden fleece to Zeus, and then gave the fleece to Aeetes, the ruler of Colchis. Aeetes hung it on a tree in a garden sacred to the god Ares. That very detailed background story on the golden fleece is provided in Apollodorus' library, likely written in the 2nd century AD. But how does this later account compare to the earlier pieces of literature that mentioned the golden fleece? In the oldest surviving source from the 7th century BC, Hesiod's Catalogue of Women, Nephele provides the golden ram to her children Phrixus and Helle. A couple hundred years later, in the 5th century BC, the poet Pindar shares that the ram saved young Phrixus from both the dangers of the sea and his stepmother. Pindar says the ram skin now belongs to King Aeetes. Art, from the same period, shows Phrixus riding on the ram. And what about the main source for the Jason and the Argonaut adventure, the epic poem The Argonautica by Apollonius of Rhodes? Apollonius gives little tidbits on the ram's backstory throughout his poem. They are, roughly, that Hermes made the ram have golden fleece, that the ram carried Phrixus and his sister across the sea, but that the girl Helle fell off, and that the ram continued on and took Phrixus to the home of King Aeetes. So, there you have it. All of these versions are quite close in their main points. Apollodorus provides a number of details, likely getting them from older but now lost records, but essentially we have a common tradition for the Golden Fleece originating somewhere in the Archaic period and carrying through all the way to Apollodorus almost 1,000 years later. For what it's worth, though, there is a different tradition that appears to pop up in the later centuries. This one is recorded by the Roman Hyginus in the 2nd century AD. It's similar to the other tradition, but the evil stepmother part is left out. In this one, Phrixus and Helle, instead of on the verge of being sacrificed, are wandering lost in a forest, due to the god Dionysus driving them insane. Nephele again shows up and has them ride the ram over the sea to King Aeetes. The girl Helle again falls in the sea on the way. In all versions, though, the core details remain the same. Phrixus is saved, and in the end, the golden fleece ends up in the possession of King Aeetes of Colchis. And now back to the Argonautica. Once Jason received and accepted his quest, careful preparations were in order. You might be tempted to think this quest might involve some convoluted treasure hunt, where Jason has to first find out where the golden fleece is located. It's possible he found out where it was from an oracle. The Argonautica makes an offhand reference to an oracle that gave Jason advice on how to start his quest, but we don't get specifics or an actual scene of them speaking. The likely reason in the poem for the lack of treasure hunt is it was public knowledge already. Apollonius even puts some of the backstory of the Golden Fleece in the mouths of two women talking in the street. Everyone already knew where the fleece was supposed to be, in Colchis. It was just incredibly far away and extremely dangerous to get to. So if the location of the Golden Fleece was known, what was the oracle for? I think after Jason accepted his mission to travel to Colchis and secure the fleece, he consulted an oracle asking how he was to go about getting there. The oracle likely told him the first thing he needed for a voyage to Colchis was a ship, and the second thing was a crew to man it. Fortunately for Jason, he had the favor of the gods. The goddess Athena appeared to a talented shipbuilder named Argus and gave him instructions and guidance in building a new ship, called the Argo, after Argus himself. While the ship was being built, Jason needed to secure a crew of trusty companions for it. A call went out across Greece for those great and skilled and looking for glory to join in the quest for the Golden Fleece. That call was answered by many of the greatest heroes of that generation. There was Orpheus, a skilled musician from Thrace. Orpheus was the brother of Linos, the music teacher a young Heracles killed. Orpheus came with a recommendation from Jason's teacher, the centaur Chiron, on account of his musical prowess. Men whispered that Orpheus's songs could charm the rocks of mountains, alter the course of flowing rivers, and even cause groves of oak trees to move around and follow him. There was Typhus, son of Hagnias. He was a skilled sailor and sea captain, who understood the rising waves of the broad sea. He could navigate based on the sun and stars, tell when storm winds were on their way, and when was the best time for sailing. The goddess Athena herself went to Typhus and urged him to go join Jason and be the one to steer the Argo. Several heroes who also answered the call were the children of various immortals. There was Castor and Polydeux. These hero twins were the sons of Zeus and the Spartan queen Leda. Like with Heracles, they also had a human father named Tyndareus. These two heroes were horsemen, and Polydeux was a talented boxer. The brothers Eurytus and Echion were sons of Hermes. They were skilled craftsmen, perfect for fixing the leaks and breaks the Argo might experience in its planned voyage. Athalides was another son of Hermes. He was a very fast runner, and his father Hermes granted him a fantastic memory that allowed him to recall all sorts of information. Naturally, he would serve as the group's herald, or messenger. Idmon was a son of Apollo, and the god taught him the art of prophecy, how to listen to birds and read the flames of sacrifices to find out the will of the gods. Idmon is actually one of two soothsayers among the Argonauts. The other was named Mopsus, the son of a human man and a nymph. He was also taught the art of prophecy by Apollo, specifically how to make oracles by observing how birds flew through the sky. There were a handful of heroes fathered by Poseidon. Euphemus, the fastest runner in the world. He was so fast he could run over the surface of the sea without getting his ankles wet. In addition to him, there was Nauplius, Erginus of Miletus, and Ancaeus of Parthenia. All three were sons of Poseidon, and they were skilled sailors, perfect for a heroic boat trip. Palamonius was a son of Hephaestus, and he was deformed like his divine father, but very strong. Zetes and Calais, sons of Boreas, the North Wind, and from Thrace, are two of the strangest Argonauts. Their father, Boreas, kidnapped their mother and raped her, and the two twins took on some of their father's windy nature. The brothers could fly. They had wings that gleamed with golden scales and allowed them to rise up into the air. There's also some heroes I've already covered in past episodes, or will cover in more detail in future ones. Heracles joined too, along with his young friend Hylas. Apollonius places the Argonauts' voyage during the same time Heracles was completing his labors. In this version, Heracles joins up after capturing the Erymanthian boar. From Calydon came Meleager, son of Calydon's king Oeneus, along with Oeneus's half-brother, Laocoon. Meleager was very young, and his father sent his uncle to watch over him on the voyage. He didn't really need it, though. Highly skilled in javelin and hand-to-hand fighting, only Heracles was supposed to be superior to Meleager out of the whole group of Argonauts. I will come back to Meleager in a later episode, when he's older and has had some other adventures. Also joining the crew was Coronis, son of Caeneus. The young man's father was originally a woman. She was raped by Poseidon and asked to be turned into a man afterwards. I briefly talked about Caeneus in the Poseidon episode. Periclymenus was the eldest son of Neleus, king of Pylos. That made him the king Pelias's nephew, and a distant relative of Jason. He was a favorite of the god Poseidon, and the god granted him boundless strength and an ability to shapeshift. Years after this adventure, he's going to be killed by Heracles. Clytius and Iphitus were the sons of Eurytos the Ruthless of Ocalia. Their father is the same Eurytos who taught a young Heracles archery, so before this voyage, and who Heracles later had problems with. Cepheus, son of Hippocoon, king of Sparta. He's another one who later had a fatal run-in with Heracles. Augeas was a son of Helios, and a king ruling the land of Elis. This is in fact the same man who Heracles would later clean out his stables as one of his labors and also fight a war against. Augeas took a break from ruling Elis to join the Argonauts. He was driven by curiosity and wanted to travel to Colchis and see its wonders. Telamon and Peleus, the sons of Aeacus, both came to Iolcos, but not together. Both brothers lived in separate places. In their youth, they killed their brother Phocas and were exiled from their homelands. They went their separate ways. Today, Telamon and Peleus are both overshadowed by their better-known children, who participate in the Trojan War a generation later. But these two were celebrated heroes in their own right. After the Argonauts' adventure, Telamon would go on to join Heracles in going to the land of the Amazons and his attack on Troy. Peleus, like Jason, had a friendly relationship with the centaur Chiron. He had other adventures besides the voyage of the Golden Fleece, but I'm saving those for a later episode. Something to know right now, though, he had a child, the immortal nymph Thetis. Two more Argonaut brothers were Lynceus and Idas, sons of Aphareus, king of Mycene. They, in particular Idas, may have also been sons of Poseidon. Lynceus had excellent eyesight. He would serve as the lookout on the Argo. His brother Idas is one Greek hero who probably had his own collection of myths, with few surviving to us today. There is one story hinted in Homer's Iliad that tells how he was involved in a love triangle with a woman named Marpessa and the god Apollo. Idas and Apollo apparently fought in an archery contest over her. The later Library of Apollodorus adds some more details, saying Zeus stopped the fight and made Marpessa choose between them. She chose Idas because Apollo wouldn't age and she feared he would desert her when she got old and became wrinkled. Presumably after getting married, Idas got the call for adventure and set out with his brother Lynceus. Finally, with all those names, what's a far-flung adventure without a little bit of family support? Iphicles was Jason's uncle, the brother of Jason's mother. He joined the group because he was family and wanted to watch out for his nephew. Coming along too was Acastus, the young son of Peleas. Yes, the same Peleas who told Jason to go on the journey to Colchis in the first place. I guess the sweet temptations of adventure didn't stop him from joining his father's enemy. And that's not even all the heroes. Apollonius's Argonautica lists many more names. One of my favorites is another Ancaeus. His worried grandfather hid his armor to try and prevent him from leaving. But Ancaeus was so keen to join, he left anyway, only wearing the skin of a bear and carrying a huge two-sided battle axe. With his lack of clothes and his unique weapon, he reminds me a little of Heracles. For the most part, though, the remaining heroes are little more than names. Different literary sources also don't agree on all the Argonauts. There is a consistent core group of around 25 that appears in all or almost all of the available sources. But there's really only a small handful of these who are actually going to have very specific roles in the Argonautic of Home. Maybe they had roles to play in other now-lost versions. I think it's safe to say that there were some earlier stories that featured each hero using their special talents to help move the group forward together. But in Apollonius's Argonautica, a lot of them don't do much and just appear along for the ride. Besides the core group, there are a whole bunch of Argonauts who appear in one source or a small handful of them. And it seems two things were going on with this group of others. Some of them are well-known heroes who appear in other poetic works. People like Theseus, Autolycus, Nestor, Laertes, Asclepius. A few of these don't even make sense in a potential timeline of Greek mythology. These heroes were likely later additions to the epic tradition, as poets tried to tie other famous heroes into the story. But there's also a whole lot of other, more unknown Argonauts, usually people who are only listed as a name, who their father is, and where they came from. These were likely heroes who had a very localized myth tradition. Having them feature in an Argonaut story created prestige for the community they were linked to. Traveling bards added them in to make their audiences feel good. Some of these heroes may have had more detailed mythological biographies outside of their Argonaut cameo, but because they were very local, their stories were not widely popular and were never written down. The whole group of Argonauts was sometimes referred to as Minyans. This itself is a little strange, as the Minyans were a group of people based in the city of Orchomenos, not Iolcos. In some traditions, though, Jason, through his mother, and some of the other Argonauts, were considered minions. It could be evidence of some kind of relationship between Iolcos and Orchomenos, or, alternatively, some role for Orchomenos in earlier, now-lost versions of the myth. But back to the story. The call to adventure went out, and the heroes assembled in Iolcos from all across Greece, ready to join Jason in his quest to retrieve the Golden Fleece. But one hero was turned away, traveling all the way from her home in the wild southern region of Arcadia, came the young woman, Atalanta. She asked Jason if she could join the crew, even gave him a spear as a present. But Jason declined. His reason was, basically, that she was a woman, and he didn't want to create strife between all the male Argonauts when a few of them would, inevitably, be attracted to her. It's a lame excuse. For what it's worth, though, that's Apollonius's version. Centuries later, some writers, like Diodorus and Apollodorus, did have Atalanta successfully join the Argonauts. On the day the voyage was set to start, the streets of Iolcos were filled with onlookers. Women raised their hands to the sky in prayer, hoping the immortals would grant a return to the heroes. Others confidently boasted that the Argonauts would succeed, that the heroes would burn Colchis to the ground if Aeetes did not yield the Golden Fleece to them. Jason's mother was filled with grief and worry. She threw her arms around her son, clinging to him and weeping. Jason quickly soothed her pain and told her it would be all right. He left her house and passed through a crowd filling the streets outside. A priestess came forward and kissed his hand. He slowly made his way outside the walls of Iolcos and down to the beach, where the Argonauts were already assembled. Jason told the group to select a leader. It's an interesting moment. Jason is the one who must bring back the Golden Fleece. Jason is the one who made the call for these heroes to join him. It's Jason's hometown where they are all assembled. It's Jason that the story has followed so far. Making Jason their leader seems like a no-brainer. So Jason asks the question, asking them to choose the bravest of the group, someone who will be responsible and who will deal with any quarrels or discussions with strangers that they meet on their voyage. And they all turned their heads to Heracles, and all together asked him to be their leader. It's a strange narrative choice by Apollonius. He uses this moment to completely upstage the main character of his own poem. But Heracles let his comrade's shouts quiet down and lifted up his hand. He said, "Let no one offer this honor to me, for I will not consent, and I will forbid any other to stand up. Let the hero who brought us together himself be the leader of the host." And with that, Heracles declined, and also removed any other opposition. Jason became the leader of the Argonauts. Jason's first act as leader was to tell the heroes to prepare a sacrifice to Apollo and hold a great feast on the beach. Why Apollo? In his commands, Jason alludes to a previous prophecy he received from the gods. It's not covered in the Argonautica poem, but it likely occurred after Pelias ordered Jason to retrieve the Golden Fleece, but before all the heroes arrived in Iolcos. At the oracle, Apollo promised Jason that he would show him the way through the sea if Jason started his adventure with a sacrifice. This is in fact going to be the first of many sacrifices to Apollo. The reason being, and it might surprise you, that in ancient Greece Apollo was actually an important god for sailors. Jason's servants brought two bulls for the sacrifice, and Heracles and Ancaeus kill them. Heracles by using his club to smack the creature in the middle of the head. All the while, Jason says a prayer, asking Apollo to accept the sacrifice, and he asked for good winds and the god's advice. The bull flesh was cooked over the sacrificial flames and then eaten, while wine was poured out in an offering. Finally, Idmon looked into the altar's flames and foretold the words of Apollo, that the heroes were destined to return to Iolcos with the Golden Fleece, but would face countless trials on the way. Idmon also told the group it was his fate to die on the journey. The heroes cheered when they heard they would return, but at the same time they felt sad for Idmon. After the sacrifice, they lied down on the beach in rows, piling leaves to make their beds. the heroes then had essentially a big sleepover party, drinking wine and telling tales to each other. This won't be the last time the men do this either. But this time, Jason sat quietly, brooding to himself about the coming adventure. Eventually, the hero Idas noticed and tried to cheer him up with a boast. "Look at my spear," he said. "With it, I win renown more than any other. Zeus does not help me as much as this spear. No challenge will be fatal. No venture will go unfinished while I, Idas, am here, even if one of the gods stands against you." The arrogant words brought Jason out of his daze, but they alarmed the other heroes. Idmon warned Idas about such talk. "Vain wretch, you are creating your own destruction. Does the wine swell your heart and cause you to dishonor the gods? There are other ways to encourage a friend, but you have chosen recklessness." An argument broke out, and a fight would have too, but Orpheus lifted his lyre and began to sing. He sang about how the earth, heaven, and sea were formed, how the paths of the stars, moon, and sun were fixed in the sky, and how the titans Cronos and Rhea ruled over the universe while Zeus was still a baby hidden in a cave. The song brought peace to the group, and they forgot their argument and sat around, faces forward, backs bent with eagerness, all silent and carefully listening to Orpheus's song. Afterwards, they poured more libations, this time to Zeus, and then rolled up in their leaves and went to sleep. At the first light of dawn, Typhus awoke. He woke the rest of the heroes and told them to ready the oars. Typhus sat at the helm of the ship, since he was given the task of steering. As the two largest Argonauts, Heracles and Ancaeus took the middle seats of the rowing benches. When Heracles entered the ship, it noticeably sank a little lower in the water. The rest of the heroes drew lots to figure out where each of them would sit. When they were ready, the Argo itself told them when to begin. Yes, you heard that right. The ship talks. When it was being built, the goddess Athena went to a grove of trees sacred to Zeus and made the ship's beam from some of the oak there. This is what gave it the power of speech. It's not going to talk much in the adventure, so put the idea of some sassy ship out of your mind. I interpret it being more like a telephone, with the beam able to transmit messages from the gods. Anyway, the ship says go, the Argonauts pull on their oars, and the Argo moves out to sea. Tears came to Jason's eyes as he turned his face away from home. Orpheus played on his lyre, water broke over the blades of the oars, and the sea around the ship frothed and bubbled with the might of the heroic crew. While they left, the gods watched them. On land, the centaur Chiron came down to the water. His wife stood with him, and in her arms was a cute little baby named Achilles. The three of them waved goodbye to Peleus, the boy's father, and the rest of the crew of his fellow Argonauts. And that's all for today. I will pick up with the adventure in the next episode of Myth Madness, so stay tuned. As always, thank you for listening.